Hi, I'm Eric Jansen. You're tuned to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. This week, Radically Gay, the life of Harry Hay. Gay rights pioneer and labor activist Harry Hay is being honored with an exhibit now on display at San Francisco's Public Library celebrating the 100th anniversary of his birth. He was a labor advocate, teacher, and early leader in the gay rights movement, known for, among other things, founding the Radical Fairies in the late 1970s and the Mattachine Society, the first sustained political gay rights group in the U.S. in the early 1950s, 60 years ago. With me to talk about Harry Hay's life and legacy are three very distinguished guest experts. Joey Kane is an activist, historian, and curator specializing in gay men's history. He served on the San Francisco Pride Celebration Committee for 10 years, including 4 years as president, and his writings have appeared in the Walt Whitman Quarterly and RFD, Rural Ferry Digest magazine. He's curator of the current library exhibit, Radically Gay, The Life of Harry Hay, which runs through July 29th. Welcome, Joey.
Thank you.
Sally Hay is Harry Hay's niece. She's an out lesbian and a longtime LGBTQ activist in Rhode Island, where she's also a psychiatric social worker and lives with her partner of 16 years. Although she'd met her famous uncle when a child, she got to know him well just in the last 6 years of his life. Sally Hay, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you.
Also with us here in the studio is Will Roscoe, author and editor of numerous books in LGBT studies. He's received two Lambda Literary Awards, and for his book, The Zuni Man-Woman, the Margaret Mead Award of the American Anthropological Association. A friend and colleague of Harry Hay for nearly 25 years, he's the editor of Hay's writings, Radically Gay, Gay Liberation in the Words of Its Founder. Will Roscoe, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Thanks to all of you for being here. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the current exhibit, Radically Gay, The Life of Harry Hay. Joey Kane, what inspired you to put this exhibit together, and why do you think people should know about Harry Hay's life and legacy?
The library has Harry Hay's archives, and knowing that this was going to be the centennial year of his birth, I and a few other people looked at ways to honor and actually keep his memory alive. And one of the ideas we came up with was doing an exhibition at the San Francisco Public Library, drawing on their resources. The larger question may be, why even do anything about Harry Hay? And I think the answer to that is that, quite simply, he's probably the most important person in American gay history in the 20th century. The work that he did back in the 50s with the founding of Mattachine kind of laid the groundwork for everything else that came afterwards.
So now the exhibit is laid out in chronological order, taking the visitor mm-hmm. through Harry Hay's life, and there's a lot packed into this small exhibit room. But so let's look at the high points, not necessarily in chronological order. Mm-hmm. His co-founding of the Mattachine Society, first of all, which was originally called the Society of Fools. Is that right?
That was an operative title. It's true that it eventually was co-founded with other people, but it literally was Harry's idea in 1948, the idea of forming an organization that not only struggled for civil rights, but that actually was about gay people coming to understand who they are, to sit with each other and talk about what their lives were like and what their lives were about. And that idea, he continuously looked for other people to start this organization, and it took him 2 years before he found even one other person. And then it took them, the two of them, another 6 months before they found three other people.
And that's because this is the climate of the 1950s.
There's a lot of stuff going on. It's the 1950s. There's, of course, an intense persecution of gay people through entrapment laws, through various things like that. But there's also gay people themselves really weren't sure they even had anything else in common with other gay people except the fact that they like having sex with people of the same sex. You had people who were incredibly oppressed and incredibly put down to the point where they didn't even understand their oppression on any kind of deep basis.
And there was no sense of recognizing commonality, right? That
there was,
they shared positive, and that coming together for positive reasons, to ally with each other rather than to share their shame.
Right. To come together to understand what they had in common besides sex. I mean, right. Sex is fabulous. Yes. And as I found out in putting this exhibit together, I think there was a lot more sex going on in the late 40s than there is now, even here in San Francisco, because Harry was meeting people just walking down the street and having the eye connection or going to the parks. And while he was trying to form this organization, he was also, you know, earlier in his life had a pretty full sexual experience. Of course, by the time he was starting the Mattachine Society in the late 40s, early 50s, he had also gone through 10 years of being married.
Right.
And there's another piece of this, too. Mm-hmm. When Harry started Mattachine in 1950, he was about 40. He already had a long experience behind him of being involved in leftist and progressive causes in Southern California. And in 1938, he joined the Communist Party. And for him, he saw the persecution of communists and the persecution of homosexuals as two sides of the same coin, which was a danger in American politics of fascism. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the Second World War, he became convinced that gays or homosexuals were at risk of becoming the new big political scapegoat. I think Joey said this a while ago when we were chatting. At that point in time, after the Holocaust, the Jews were off the hook a little bit. But he was sure that the society was going to hunt around for some other scapegoat, and he was afraid it would be us. And as bad as the persecution was, he feared more of that. Yeah. So it was a combination of having lived a semi-underground life as a member of the left, certainly an underground life as a homosexual, that starting it was fraught. They talk about closing the curtains when they had their windows, putting a pillow on the telephone in case it was bugged.
Showing up to meetings in couples, male and female couples.
And pretending to be straight.
Right? Pretending to be straight.
Saying they were there because their friend is that way.
Yes. So were there many women who were involved in the organization, at least for the purpose of...
No, there weren't a lot of women. There were a few women. Probably the best known was the photographer Ruth Bernhard. But although it was ostensibly open to men and women, it really focused on male issues. And the issue that eventually it focused on and prosecuted a famous case was entrapment of men out cruising for sex, which obviously was a male issue, not a lesbian issue.
Yeah, I specifically want to ask you about this. So this is the trial of co-founder Dale Jennings.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he actually won his case.
Right.
So tell us about this and how unusual it was at this time.
Well, Dale had been entrapped in a public men's room. Long story, he was followed by this undercover agent home. The agent forced his way in, arrested him. And by this point, the original... Mattachine had started. Mattachine really had its first meeting in late 1950, November 11th, 1950, and the entrapment happened in early 52. The original group of founders met. Harry bailed Dale out of jail. Mm-hmm. They all met together.
Supposedly at the Brown Derby restaurant.
Supposedly at the Brown Derby restaurant.
Where all the big deals are made.
That's it.
Yeah.
And they decided to fight the charge, which was almost unheard of at this point. Mm-hmm. Being entrapped, being exposed and outed as a homosexual meant your name got into the newspapers. It meant you would lose your job. It meant that your family, you would be disgraced from your family.
Evicted.
And so most men who had been entrapped would just go along, pay the exorbitant fine, pay an exorbitant lawyer fee. And there were these institutions that made out pretty well terrorizing gay men. So they decided to fight the charge. And they got a lawyer, George Shibley was his name. He had been involved in defending some communists. And he very eloquently and forcefully defended Dale. The great element of his defense was he admitted he was a homosexual. which was unheard of. But that just because he was a homosexual doesn't mean that he was out cruising for sex. And that this cop lied. Well, eventually the cop was caught in a lie. The trial was, what was the word?
It was a hung jury, actually.
Was it a hung jury? And then the prosecutors decided not to retry.
It was 11-1 or something like that. According to the Wikipedia article, you're right.
It was 11-1. There was one person that held out who said, you know, he's a homosexual, he's guilty, even though the 11. And so it was a tremendous victory for all gay people.
And by that time, 1952, the organization had taken off. There were 20 or more what they call discussion groups of 10, 15, 50, and sometimes even more people throughout Southern California. And they went about organizing pretty much just the way you go about organizing a community issue today. They made leaflets. They left them on buses for people to find. They had some sympathetic baggers at grocery stores who'd stick them in the grocery
shops
of people who looked sympathetic.
Okay.
It's kind of remarkable when we look back and we think that because the Mattachine survived in name only after the period in which Harry was active as a much less political, much less assertive, very assimilationist type of organization, so that people like Joey and I, when we come out in the early 70s, we just think that it was that bad thing that was in the way of the more radical groups that we have now. Mm-hmm. So now we learn this history, and we see that in 1952, they were doing a petition, they were doing the flyers, they were doing public events. At a gay level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Harry had been doing these things for 20 years. He'd been doing them around African-American rights, around Mexican-American rights, around labor issues. It was second nature to him. Mm-hmm. Call a meeting.
He knew how to organize. He'd been trained to be an organizer.
And I think that's the most important point to make about Harry, because there are many fabulous gay people, wonderful people who have made contributions throughout the 20th century, who have articulated critiques of homophobia, who've challenged society's discrimination, but none of them called a meeting. Mm-hmm. Harry was the one who actually called a meeting.
So he organized them. He was able to organize labor type.
So he wasn't the first to speak out. He wasn't the first to take a risk. He wasn't the first to let the world know that, yes, he was a homosexual, but he was the first to actually call a meeting and to bring people together.
To organize. Okay.
I don't want to spend a whole lot more time on the Mattachine Society, but I do want to know, you know, so why did it eventually fall apart, and how long did it was really big for about maybe 10 years?
No. What happened
Mattachine was... Mattachine 1 and Mattachine 2.
After the victory in the Dale Jennings case, Mattachine, which was sort of a secret organization in a way, it was flooded with new members, and these new members who came in weren't as carefully sort of chosen, and they weren't as carefully introduced and talked to, and you started to have essentially what there was a demand for a more open democratic organization. Mattachine had been a secret organization with the top leadership. The leadership was willing to do that. They were more than happy to go along with it. Another element that entered was this was the period of extreme communist red baiting, the anti-communist hysteria that was going on. And out of the original five members who met to form Mattachine, three had been members of the Communist Party, and one had been a leftist from Austria who had fled Hitler's Germany. So you have a very, you know, it's left-wing, it's communist, the people who founded Mattachine. You started to have people who were freaked out about that, and through a series of conventions that took place in 1953, the original leadership was essentially forced out. And it was the end.
And they resigned
They resigned. Right. Yeah, they did. They did resign. They came forward. They told people who they were because it was still secret. People didn't know who the leadership was, and that has always been described sort of the period of first Mattachine, and there was then a Mattachine that sort of came out of that. But as Will had mentioned earlier, unlike the first Mattachine, which saw homosexuals organizing for their own freedom and taking action for their own freedom, the second Mattachine wanted to get sympathetic straight people to come in, doctors and lawyers, to argue on their behalf, and that we would not do it ourselves. And that was sort of the second Mattachine. there was a huge loss of membership from the first Mattachine. And the Mattachine Society went on well into the 70s.
Different chapters in cities.
Yeah, chapters around the country and stuff. It wasn't really a central organization, but I know I came out in Buffalo, New York in the early 70s, and there was a Mattachine Society there.
Okay. You're listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. We're talking about Harry Hay, whose life and legacy are featured in an exhibit at the San Francisco Public Library called Radically Gay, The Life of Harry Hay. The exhibit is up through July 29th. My guests are exhibit curator Joey Kane, writer and historian Will Roscoe, and Harry's niece, Sally Hay, an LGBTQ activist who lives in Rhode Island. Sally, I want to get your story a little bit since you're here on a sort of a rare visit here in San Francisco. You'd met your uncle early in life as a child, but didn't really get to know him until his last 6 years. And so can you tell us how you first met him and then how you happened to get reacquainted with him much later?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I grew up, my family lived about 45 miles outside of L.A., and so we weren't that far away, but we just never saw Harry. I didn't know who he was. We'd go visit my grandmother. There was a photograph that I later realized was of Harry that was very prominently displayed in the house, but we never discussed who he was. And one time, my dad got in a new car, and we got in the car, and the family's out bopping around checking out the new car, and we dropped in on Granny. And Harry was there. And what I remember was that, it was the man in the picture. And I said, oh, my goodness, that's who he is. And the other thing was that we never discussed who he was. That day, nobody talked about who he was.
So now, when you were 6 years old, he was already famous. And when you say the man in the picture, what picture are you talking about?
I'm sorry. It's the photograph my grandmother had in the house of him. Harry and his mother had a very close, very special relationship. And she'd actually been, in her own way, supportive of the Mattachine Society and was somewhat aware of his life and his activism, but not
and
real
that's,
keen
that's out. Actually, since you, let me interrupt you for a second. That's sure. One of the exhibits I remember seeing in the museum. One of the items I remember seeing in the museum exhibit is a letter from his mother talking about, I don't know, remind me, Joey,
it was a response to a member of the Mattachine Society who had written wanting to know about this other lawyer who had incorporated the Mattachine Society and he had been a hostile witness before the House Un-American Activities Committee at a hearing, and this member was demanding to know what is this person's allegiance to communism, what's his connection with the Communist Party, and
this board member was asking about Harry's
the board this Mattachine membership. Member was right. asking about not Harry but
right.
about the lawyer. That Mattachine had hired to incorporate themselves.
Okay.
And at this point, the Mattachine Foundation was interesting. It was sort of a front group made up of straight people. And those straight people were Harry's mother and another Mattachine member's mother and sister. And so Harry's mother is writing this letter as a member of the board of the Mattachine Foundation. And in it, she basically says, I don't care what someone's political affiliation is. I'm just interested that they're willing to, organize to achieve rights for this oppressed sexual minority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really tries to sidestep the whole issue of the communism, which fits because...
But because of Harry's communism and then because he left the party to start the gay movement and in the process ended his marriage...
Right.
And eventually two adopted daughters. And that's why he wasn't spoken
exactly.
of.
Yeah. No, thank you for making that connection. I forget everybody doesn't know that. Yes, I grew up knowing his wife and children. They were my cousins and my aunt, but we'd never discussed Harry.
Ah, so Harry was estranged from the family. You knew...
Absolutely.
Oh, I see, okay.
Hugely. Uh-huh. And I was sharing with the fellows before we came in today that when I started learning about Harry and his role in our history, gay lesbian history, I wondered why I hadn't known him. Because my father was very outspoken and had his own views, but he'd never said anything, and my father's his brother, he'd never said anything homophobic. And so I really didn't know why I didn't know Harry growing up. And it wasn't until I read Stuart Timmons' book that I found out he'd been a communist. And my father was a rabid anti-communist. And my father would not allow Harry or Anita, his wife, in the house.
Mm-hmm.
We would see her at Granny's because, I'm sorry, Granny is Harry's
right.
mother. she was also very attached to Anita. And I think somewhat out of fondness and somewhat out of loyalty to Harry, she maintained a very close connection with Anita and the, Harry's daughters.
So now you said Harry had a very good relationship with his mother, but not so much with his father. As a matter of fact, it was pretty horrible.
And his mother is pretty distant, but she was more accepting, and she was as warm as she could be to him.
Can you, what do you know anything more about his childhood? Any of you? I mean,
oh, lots.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, there are books and movies made about
that. But I mean, you know, generally, what's seen as sort of the pivotal event in young Harry's life and his relationship with his father. And I should give a little background. His father, although early in their life, Harry's family was very wealthy. Harry's father made him work for every single penny that he earned. And his father was very strict, very authoritarian. And the famous story is that one night at the dinner table, Harry's father had made a comment about something about Egypt. And earlier that day in a school textbook, Harry had just read what his father was talking about. And he knew his father was wrong. And he spoke up at the dinner table and said, "You're wrong." At which point the table went dead silent. People waited for Harry to apologize. He didn't. His father grabbed Harry by the ear and dragged him out to behind the house and beat him pretty savagely. And when he was done, Harry went back up into his bedroom, looked in his textbook, and realized that, yes, he was right. And that night he had his revelation that if his father could be wrong, the teacher could be wrong. And if the teacher could be wrong, the priest could be wrong. And if the priest could be wrong, God could be wrong. And from that night, he traced his lack of guilt about not only his sexuality, but about what he thought. And it really was a formative moment. And again, it was him reacting to the strict authoritarianism of his father.
If I can jump in there,
please.
One of the things that Harry and I enjoyed talking about in those last few years is, as a psychiatric social worker, I work with a lot of LGBTQ folks, and one of the things I've often worked with people around was that as outlaws in our society, that LGBTQ folks who get to where they accept themselves for who they are become a real threat because we take on being the authorities in our own lives. Mm-hmm. And if we're the authorities in our lives, we threaten churches, you know, politics, families. And it was great fun for us that to realize that, that our work sort of overlapped there in the last few years.
Mm-hmm. One of the things in the exhibit also is an Edward Carpenter book, Joey, which is featured in this exhibit where he first saw the word homosexual. Tell us a little bit about that.
Again, it was he was around nine or 10 years old, and Harry was incredibly precocious. He'd been taught to read by a favorite aunt when he was 5 years old and claims to have read every book in his local public library. Yeah. And he managed to trick the librarian into leaving the library so that he could get into the locked case behind the librarian's desk. It's a cute story. She wanted to get a certain new type of hairdo. Harry said, "Oh, you should go get it. I'll watch the library." She trained him for a couple of weeks, went off, and as soon as she stepped out the door, he was in that case. He was hoping to find pictures of naked men in the case. What he ended up finding were engravings of naked women. But he kept on looking through, and he, for the first time, found Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. He didn't find it that interesting, but then he found this book that had the word sex on the title, and it was, we think it was Carpenter's Intermediate Sex Among Primitive Folk. And he starts looking through it, and he sees there's stories of men living and loving with men, and he's like, "Oh, this is interesting." And he keeps on reading, and he finds the word homosexual, and he doesn't know what it means. He goes to the dictionary to look it up. It's not in the dictionary. It's not in any encyclopedia. But he intrinsically knows, instinctually knows, that that word has something to do with him.
The Carpenter book, though, was historical and also anthropological, talking about roles around the world, which we now kind of tend to think of as alternative gender roles. And one of them was the Native American two-spirit or Berdash tradition, which impressed him very much. And later he spent a great deal of time doing research and studying that tradition and similar ones around the world, which informed him very much in his thinking about us as a minority. And his influence on me was significant in that it inspired me to do research into the subject of the two-spirit, which is where I've published mostly.
And did his knowledge and affinity for Native American societies and attitudes, especially regarding two-spirit people, did that have an effect on him being a co-founder of the Radical Fairies?
Well, yes. He had a long relationship of different kinds over his life with Native people, going back to his participation in a youth group with a leader who had personal relationships with Hopi elders. In the 1960s, he became involved in a group called the Committee for Traditional Indian Land and Life, who were urban-based folks trying to support people on the reservation who are either restoring or maintaining traditional Native ways. And he learned much about Native people, spent a lot of times in their communities, about their decision-making processes, their ceremonial life, but also the recovery of their ceremonial life. He saw tribes where he had lost ceremonies. He saw how they could sometimes be brought back. Mm-hmm. So in the Faeries, I never, ever felt that he was recommending anything that was because the Natives did this.
No.
But he understood ceremony and ritual, mm-hmm. and he understood recovering and discovering. He used to say that if we cannot find ourselves in history, then we invent.
Right.
And so it was a powerful influence on him. And so there were many of that was absorbed into the Faeries. The Faeries themselves came in with a lot of different experiences and consensus-based
Lots.
Groups
mm-hmm.
and New Age groups and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it was a powerful and potent mixture of mm-hmm. Some creative folks.
Mm-hmm. As I said, time has flown.
Yep.
We're not out of time yet, but I do want to make sure we talk about the Radical Faeries. What are the Radical Faeries, you know, and what influence do you think the Radical Faeries have had on other gay and queer organizations?
Mm. Well, I have no problems defining the Radical Faeries. For me, it was queer men, gay men, who came together to explore and understand who they were, not that much different from what Mattachine was about, to look at ourselves politically, culturally, sexually, emotionally, and understand who we are, and then to go back out into the world and let the world know who we are. And we used a lot, you know, to me, that's the basic underlying thing. The history of the Faeries is it came in at the end of the 70s. There'd been a lot of what we would call assimilation. What had been sort of an edgy gay movement in the early 70s was becoming fairly mainstreamed by the mid to late 70s. And the call that was put out for the gathering brought together all of these gay men who had been outside of that mainstreaming of the gay culture. There was lots of stuff going on. It's actually a whole field of history that needs to be explored. Was the left-wing, collectivist, radical gay...
So for someone who's not familiar with the Radical Faeries at all, what's your like 10-word description?
Oh, God.
Well, see, Michael, I belong to a similar organization called the Billies, which I say, well, right. Shorthand is gay guys cavorting in the
sure,
woods.
We're,
but really, they have a more spirit-centered brotherhood.
but the Billies and the gatherings and the Faeries are what they're known most for is the events held in rural settings, retreats, several days. And this is really, again, an extension of Harry's original insight about how we needed to be able to discover who we are by getting into a space without non-gay people watching us without us thinking about them, where we could be spontaneous. How would you act if you weren't afraid of getting beaten up, basically?
Right. Yeah.
And that was a very powerful insight, a very powerful format.
Mm-hmm.
That was created, and that's the main core of what the Faeries are still about.
Right.
And
I would say, you know, what was their influence quickly? The Billies came out of the Radical Faeries, quite honestly. There's a lot of what is now seen as gay male spirituality or gay-centered spirituality that grew out of the early work mm-hmm. that the Radical Faeries did.
I'm sorry to end so abruptly, but we got to go. I want to thank my guest, activist, historian, and curator Joey Kane, author, editor, and historian Will Roscoe, and Sally Hay, Rhode Island activist and niece of Harry Hay. We've been talking about the exhibit Radically Gay, The Life of Harry Hay, curated by Joey Kane and on display at the San Francisco Public Library's main branch through July 29th. You can find more information about the exhibit on the San Francisco Public Library's website, sfpl.org. The Schiff Hardin Law Firm proudly supports Out in the Bay and the San Francisco Pride Run. LGBT estate planning lawyer Susan Von Herman and all the attorneys in the firm's San Francisco office reflect Schiff Hardin's nationwide commitment to equality for all. Out in the Bay is the beneficiary of this year's SF Pride Run. So if you hear this broadcast before June 23rd, go sign up. There's info on our website, outinthebay.com. Out of the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW for studio use and airtime. And WY Enterprises for maintaining Out in the Bay's website, outinthebay.com. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions, so write to us, Eric at outinthebay.com and Marilyn at outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.